Hi, hello, welcome to the Bearcats Blogcast. Back again, my name is Scott, joined, as always, by Matt Oper. How's it going today, Matt?
It is going fantastic. Championship week. How could you not be excited? I know you can tell by the tone of my voice and how it's modulated that I'm really excited.
Yeah. Yes, the day basketball, and you see... Doesn't start until Friday, which is kind of disappointing. But the rest is fun.
Hey, it's day basketball. I like this a lot. Well, here's the problem. I'm kind of an adult now, chronologically. Day basketball was way more fun when you could do day drinking to go with it. So.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, 'cause if you have to work, like you just like get to keep up with the scores on your phone or. I don't know. You just watch ESPN when you're being lazy.
Yeah, I mean, look, like you can, by all means, you can day drink at work. It's just going to have consequences.
Especially depending on your line of work.
Yeah. It's going to have consequences beyond, you know, mildly upsetting the girl you got a crush on.
Yeah. Set up the big AAC tournament. But before we dive too deep, let's run through the conference awards since we were going to touch on that anyway. And UC didn't really have much to offer in that regard. Spoiler alert. All-conference first team, Rob Gray, the surprise Damian Dotson, Houston, like the first team. Of course, Semi Owale, Jalen Adams, and Dedrick Lawson, your first team all AAC. Like, pretty much everybody knew that, besides Dotson, who did finish the year pretty strong. Like, everybody knew those four since conference play started in January.
Yeah, I'd say, like, the second week of January it was pretty clear. By signing day, it was obvious.
Two Bearcats on the second team, Kyle Washington, Troy Copain, joined by BJ Taylor of UCF and like the rest of SMU's starting lineup. Like SMU, very well represented. And one of the things where having like four players play like 80% of your minutes really came in handy.
Yeah, if you play that many minutes, you're going to get numbers. And like all jokes aside, like SMU is deserving of having those four players represented on the all conference teams. Flat out. I'm not sure why Houston has merited two first team all conference players. Like they finished fourth, right? Third, my bad. But I don't see it. I mean, like, Sterling Brown has a much better case to be on the all-conference team than Damian Dotson does, period. Same thing for Kyle Washington.
That seemed Kyle were just right into, like, a positional crunch. I guess they don't really do positions, but, like, he wasn't the star front court player. And, like, they tend to go guard heavy.
Which makes sense because of the way that the sport is uniquely structured to feature guards and only guards, or big people who play like guards.
Yeah, of course, in the case of Semi especially.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have no problem with Semi, Rob Gray, you know, those guys had good years. It's just Dotson. I just don't see it. I just plain don't see it.
I guess that'd be one of the advantages of being like the one of the only good players on your team. He did average 19 points a game in league play, which probably helped a lot.
Yes, it probably helped a lot, but
just in league play, 19-7. That's not too bad. But yeah, taking like two players off of Houston really just kind of shows like how a complete a team UC was. And, like, one of, like, the deficiencies of having like such a well-rounded team. It's like you don't have a guy who stands out to be all first team. Like Sean Kilpatrick, like, oh yeah, definitely. I feel like Copain last year may have had a case. But like where you're so balanced and like pretty much every guy takes like a different stance like pretty much every game it seems. Like nobody really stood out. And like if the season ended 2 weeks ago, Washington probably would have been first team.
Yeah, that's probably the case. And you make a great point about how this team is not structured to have individual awards for guys, and that is 100% the case. Like, that SK team, when he was a senior, the whole strategy seemed to be, let's get, like, in every close game, it seemed to be, let's get to the last 5 minutes, and then SK is going to do SK things, and we'll probably win. Like, he was, to say that he was the focal point of the offense that year would be to do a massive disservice to how integral he was to the offense that year. There really was no offense to speak of without Sean Kilpatrick. Like, he created everything for this team.
And like any other year, he wins like conference player of the year. Just an incredible season, especially in hindsight, where like the three best players in the league were all first-team All-Americans.
Like that. Yeah, that doesn't happen. That's not a common occurrence.
And I, besides, like maybe like a while, like, I can't imagine anybody ending up on an All-American team in the league.
No, not this year. There's just there's just too many good players in other programs, and more to the point, there's too many good players at Blue Bloods that are going to get those looks before they even get to a guy like Semi.
The more interesting award, at least for UC, it's the all-rookie team also announced a couple of days ago. Jerron Cumberland, only unanimous selection on any of these teams. So he's definitely going to win conference rookie of the year, freshman of the year. He's joined by Vance Jackson of UConn, KJ Lawson, Memphis, Quinn Rose of Temple, and Jeremy Shepard of East Carolina. Again, that, not the best freshman class in AAC history. And it seemed like you really have to kind of like struggle to fill out the end with, especially with Jackson and Shepard. Not to say they had bad seasons, but it's like there's like three very good first-year players and the rest.
Yeah, I would have loved to see a all-rookie team that just stopped at three players. Just like, you know, hey, these three and like Jim, you want to play? Jim, we have a spot available on our team. Would you like it? Because that's going to be better than some of the other guys on the team. Like, there's just the drop-off between really the first two and the rest. Not even the first three is substantial, to say the least.
And the awards didn't stop there for Jerron Cumberland, who was named co-sixth man of the year with Ben Amelgu of SMU. Again, kind of hard to pick between them, and it seems like one of those cases where, like, I don't know if, like, SMU's coach probably couldn't vote for Amelgu, and Cronin couldn't vote for Cumberland, I guess. I don't know. Probably not. They split the vote somehow. So that means a third person got a vote, because there's 11 teams in the league, so they didn't get every single vote. But I have no idea who would have gotten the, who would be the third man would be.
Chicken Knowles? I don't know. I'm at a loss. I mean, like, it's fitting. Like, we've talked all year about how all of these teams except UC have six people.
Yeah, so, of course, they had to tie for the sixth man of the year award.
Yeah, those six men were really good. Yeah, but in all seriousness, like, for most of the year, Cumberland really had trouble on the road. Like, the difference between his production on the road and versus at home was startling, night and day. Like, there was a huge difference. But in the last month of the season, that has not been the case. He is, you know, he still had some bad games. He still had some down outings, which, you know, you expect. But his ability to produce off the bench in, you know, a limited sample size is really kind of unheard of for a Mick Cronin team.
Yeah, absolutely. And he even won the conference players of the week. Just to top it off.
Yeah, I mean, like, he is just such a gifted basketball player that this year is a phenomenal year. This team is primed for a big run in March. I was really concerned about how they would respond to the UCF loss, and I'm not gonna beat around the bush. I feared a death spiral up for this team, similar to what happened in 2014, where they just kind of melted and ran out of steam at the end of the year because, you know, they just kind of, all those starters, those frontline players for that team just kind of fell apart because of the massive minutes that they accumulated. But I don't think that's going to be a problem for this team this year because Cumberland is now playing like 25 minutes a game in his last six games. You know, the last real no-show that he had was against SMU, and if Mick had that back again, he plays him more. Because what that team needed, what was needed in that game was an offensive spark against that brutal SMU defense, and they just had nothing. And that was kind of the game that was crying out for Cumberland. And before that game came about, we talked about how they needed a big outing from him. You know, he played 7 minutes in that game, got 3 points, but that was the bulk of his contributions. It's going to be interesting to see what happens if and when they meet SMU in the finals and Cumberland plays another, you know, 25 minutes and is part of that crunch time lineup because, you know, he's something that SMU really hasn't seen before, a kind of wide-bodied kid who can go toe-to-toe with them. Those guys aren't really in abundant supply in this league. But I'm kind of salivating for that matchup, hoping that it takes place.
Interestingly enough, the two games he played the fewest minutes in conference play were both against SMU. Like, Mick didn't keep him on the floor at all. He played 18 total minutes against the Mustangs.
Yeah, and in his last six games in conference... Well, sorry, his last five games in conference, you have 31 minutes, 22 minutes, 28 minutes, 21, 25. And, like, that's more indicative of how much he played in the second half of the season after the new year than playing, you know, the combined 17 minutes again, or 18 minutes against SMU in those two games.
It's going to be really interesting to see how they do that balance, because it seems like they like the starting lineup mostly against SMU. But let's not jump too far. Let's talk about the rest of the awards real quick. Taco Fall won Defensive Player of the Year. The only other award UC really had a chance to win was if Gary Clark could win it, and he didn't. It was Taco Fall. Cameron Reynolds was Tulane's only good player, and apparently he hadn't even scored 20 points coming into this season, and he averaged like 18 points a game. So, good job, Cameron Reynolds. And Troy Copain won the Sportsmanship Award. And tomorrow, like, the big awards come out, and I can't imagine there'll be any surprises.
There will be no surprises. It will be Semi, and it will be Tim Jankovic, rightfully so.
And Cumberland will pick up his hardware.
And he will get his award.
Now let's jump ahead to the AAC tournament. SMU, the KenPom favorite, because they play on probably their easier side, especially for who they would play in the semis and finals. What are your quick thoughts on the AAC tournament? Like, do you like UC's draw? Are you a little wary?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the draw. Not so much for the quarterfinal matchup. It shouldn't matter. I really don't think it will.
They would play Tulane or...
Tulane or Tulsa. Neither of those games are much of a concern, obviously. I'm just not a fan of being on that team that shall not be named side of the bracket.
Who would be coming into a potential semifinal already playing twice. Which, if you watched any of the tournaments so far, has been a definite advantage. Is the team who seems to have played the day or two before, like as a jump on. The normally better team that they end up playing. You can't think Tulsa or Tulane will push Cincinnati in any way.
Tulsa and Tulane are not going to be a concern. Like they should roll those teams relatively easily.
And if somehow close, like that game is, UC will play 7 p.m. Friday night. So the first half of that game is going to have nobody there because it's in Hartford. And we've seen the lively atmosphere when UConn stopped playing. So if they somehow get bounced by USF, there'll be nobody at the tournament. It'll be a depressing morgue until probably the title game. It's a fun little side story.
But hasn't that been the case for all previous AAC tournaments? Actually, year one was good. Year one in Memphis was good. All the ones since then have sucked. Atmosphere-wise. I'm not talking about the quality of the basketball or the teams, etc., etc. I'm talking about just the general feeling of playing in a soulless cavern that is just trying to suck your soul out through your mouth like a Dementor.
Or at least they have stars on the floor.
Totes. Big fan of stars on the floor.
Or I guess in the paint.
I don't know. They might change up the floor logo.
I don't know. The AAC Twitter logo is the stars on the paint. So I can't imagine that will change now.
So they could get a new picture, Scott. They can change the Abbey.
No changing allowed.
And why do they give us an edit feature on Twitter?
Fair question.
It's like, better think carefully of what your avatar is, because it's yours forever. It never changes. I would have thought a lot more about my original avatar in such a situation.
I don't even remember what my original one was. It was probably something really stupid. I don't even remember why I picked the one I have now.
I don't even know what mine is.
So we're the utmost authorities about this.
I think it's Kyrie topic. Irving. I'm pretty sure it's Kyrie. Yeah, it's Kyrie.
Are there any games, just looking through the potential first and second rounds, that stand out to you? Or do you think this is kind of just going to be like SMU rolls to the finals, Cincinnati rolls to the finals? Or do you see maybe a Houston or UCF, maybe throwing a challenge? Because I'm not giving, after how Memphis quit and got hammered by 6,000 points by SMU, I'm not going to give them a chance against SMU.
No, Memphis is checked out. Really, the only interesting game from the potential first round or quarterfinals matchups is UConn-Houston. And it would just be the funniest shit in the world if USF pulled the shocker of shockers and beat UConn. I would probably laugh for a couple days if that happened. Probably not going to, but if it did, I might die from laughter.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine a case where they actually beat UConn.
No, I got nothing.
Yeah, Like, just the way the tournament's set up. Like, SMU hammered Memphis. And I think they did beat UCF. They beat a game at UCF that was kind of close. So like, maybe if like, those teams meet up in the semifinals, it'll be an interesting struggle. It's because we know UCF does one thing very well, and that's defend. And they've been playing pretty well lately. They finished regular season 20-10. So you gotta like think maybe they have a pretty decent chance.
And Houston, yeah, I mean, I expect UCF to make the semifinals just because of the aforementioned defense. You know, Taco Fall, what he does to an offense is no joke. And they have B.J. Taylor, who's playing out of his mind lately. So they have a great defense, like really a really phenomenal defense. And the one playmaker scorer that you have to make a run in this kind of tournament. And if B.J. Taylor just goes off and averages, you know, if he averages his stat line from the UC game, yeah, UCF can easily make the semifinals. And they can put a real scare into SMU. Because they're really the only team who can alter how SMU approaches offense. Because nobody else has that degree of rim protection. And because they have Taco Fall standing on the back line and they know it, they can gamble a lot more and be really aggressive on the perimeter, which really takes away their greatest advantage, which is their three-point shooting. And if you just stay in a zone, which UCF has to do to keep Taco Fall on the floor, otherwise he's just going to be put into a million pick and rolls, you can really nullify the biggest advantage SMU has, which is their switchability. Usually we talk about a team having the ability to switch as a defensive weapon. For SMU, it's an offensive weapon. I mean, if you roll out five dudes who are basically the same size, height, weight, you know, they're all, you know, there's a couple guys that are a little bit heavier, but they're still athletic enough and light enough on their feet that they can play really well on the perimeter. It makes defending them such a chore. But if you can extend your defense out while playing a zone, that really takes that advantage away from them.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what they did the first time that the teams played. It's like they just made SMU take a bunch of jump shots. And like SMU did that go, I think they went on a big run in that game. But that was a 5-point game and UCF had a chance to close it. So like, you really have to think like that's going to be everybody's strategy against SMU. You just have to hope that the Mustangs have one of those games they did when whenever they played Tulane and like they didn't make a 3-pointer like the whole entire time, it seemed.
Yeah, I mean, like, you just have to do all that and then hope they have a bad shooting night. Because doing all that is no guarantee of success.
Yeah, and like, just, like, the way their offense runs, like, they just can beat you so many ways. Like, we've all seen them just go, like, kind of go crazy from three. And I think then, like, Moore and Owale and even, like, Sterling Brown, like, they can kill the offensive glass and just really break down your defense a lot. Like they're just gonna, obviously they're gonna, the favorite, and they're going to be a really tough out. But I think that like semifinal is a pretty interesting game.
Yeah, I mean, I really think the key to beating SMU is to get them off their game. And how you do that in a couple different ways. You can do that by doing what SMU does and just kind of taking away that switchability that is such an asset for them. Or the opposite way you can do it is make them play at a pace that they are not comfortable with. Very few teams this year have been able to do that to SMU. Like, it's not a long list. And the teams that have had some sustained success for doing that, they didn't keep it up for 40 minutes. They could do it in spurts, but they couldn't do it in 40 minutes. So I really, like, but that's going to be the key to challenging that team because they're so cohesive and so comfortable on the floor with each other. That they just have this understanding of spacing and timing that can only come from having five or six guys play all the minutes. You know, they remind me so much of, like, the SMU is basically like the best pickup basketball team ever. It's like, if you walk into the gym with your friends and you sit down at the bench, call next, and as you're watching the game, you see those five guys, you turn to your friends, you're like, this is going to be a short day. We might have next. I don't think we're getting the one after that.
And like, just like the way that they've been able to come together, like they were 4-3 to start the season, and like they've just ransacked the rest of their schedule. Like once they figured it out, and like their rotation, like just settled on like the six or seven guys they end up playing, mainly the six. They've just really taken off completely. And it's like a completely different team than they were back in November, which is how they're being judged today in all the mock brackets. Just kind of unfair in a way. But I guess that's life in a small conference, or not a small conference, but a league where you don't have like 15 teams in the RPI top 10.
Yeah, I mean, like, this has been a running theme of the AAC short life, is that you got some really good teams, and you got some really bad teams, but there's no middle class. And if anything, that has been more accentuated this year, because you got two excellent, outstanding teams, both of which can make Elite Eight, Final Four runs. Like, that is in the cards for both these teams. They are capable of doing that. And then there's a massive drop-off to 3, 4, 5, 6. And then another massive drop-off to, you know, the team that fired their coach in January. And Tulsa. ECU. Like, the dregs of this conference are so... they're so bad. It's just... it's a killer to the resume of the better teams in this conference because they have to play them so much.
Which is going to make really like the biggest interesting thing about the AAC tournament is like what happens to your seeding when you lose, or if you lose. So one at SMU and Cincinnati is definitely going to lose. Like it has to happen. Like where do they end up? Because we've seen the AAC teams even back when UConn won the title, like every team in the league that year was underseeded. And we saw it last year where UC, like, were they really an 8 seed or a 9 seed? I can't remember which one they were. But no, like, they get ended up like, getting pushed down a couple of seeds, it seemed. And, like, right now they're both on the good old bracket matrix. They're both in as 5 seeds, but that's definitely not going to hold when one of them loses. Especially if one of them loses early. Like, if... like, just hypothetically, if SMU gets bounced by Temple, like, SMU's going to be, like, an 8 seed.
Yeah, like, one of these teams is going to settle on that 7-8 line. And one of them, I mean, they're probably tapped out at a 5. Like as you said, they're both currently 5, according to most projections. They can get to 4 if they, you know, if they beat the other team in the final. It's the only way. If either UC or SMU stumbles before that Titanic matchup, yeah, like, seeding gets really dicey.
If UC can make the finals, I think there's an outside chance they could get a 4. But they'd have to, it's like you have to have somebody get bounced early.
Like you'd have to have somebody get bounced early, and you'd have to have just utter chaos from like, the 16 teams in front of you.
Like, you'd have to have, like, just, like, look at the 3 and 4 seeds. Like, UCLA, Arizona, Florida State, Florida. Like, you'd have to have, like, Florida State get bounced in the first round of their first AAC tournament game.
Yeah, they need to lose tomorrow.
Butler would have to get bounced early.
Virginia has to lose to Pitt. Oh shit, they're up 11, so that's going well.
Duke already won. Like they probably won't fall behind before. And you just have to really hope Purdue gets bounced early, which they might.
Who's their matchup? I forget. I'm blanking. Hold up, stall. I'm gonna frantically Google.
Well, we don't know their matchup yet, do they? Don't they have to, somebody else have to play? I don't know. Yeah, they don't play until Friday anyway. Purdue. And West Virginia is the other 4 seed. Who knows what West Virginia does in their conference tournament? I think there's a pretty good chance you could pass up somebody if they lose and you win.
Stall.
Oh man, this is a tough one. I'll go through the possible opponents. Let's see, Vanderbilt somehow a 12 seed still. Rhode Island, 12 seed. Nevada. Ooh, Nevada will be a tricky team. Nevada is actually pretty good. But the problem with Nevada is, like, if they lose in their tournament, they're not going to make it. And UNC Wilmington already made the tournament. UNC Wilmington can be a scary team if UC ended up playing them.
So, for the Purdue disaster scenario, we need to root for Illinois to beat Michigan and then Illinois to beat Purdue. Yeah, that's not happening, so sorry.
It could happen. That crazy Big Ten.
It could happen. Ohio State almost lost. Oh, no, they did lose to Rutgers. Oh, my God. How does Thad Mata have a job? Moving on.
He's still got a job. Still coming back.
Well, yeah, he still has a job. He's still coming back because nobody cares about Ohio State basketball. Like, really, that is honestly the best job in college basketball. Like, you can make that argument because you're going to get paid $4 million a year, and it really doesn't matter if you're good at your job. Nobody cares. If you do amazing and you get to the Final Four and you make a run to the championship game, nobody cares.
That would be interesting if they did lose, if like they don't make the tournament again next year. I wonder what people start to say. I wonder if that could... They won't fire him. I can't imagine they would fire him after all the success he had. Like, I bet, like, the more the rumors about him retiring would really kick up.
No, he has a Rick Barnes fate coming. Like, that's what's going to eventually happen. Is that he's going to succeed enough that he eventually underwhelms in totality and gets fired for it. But how long was Rick Barnes at Texas? Forever? Right?
Yeah.
So you got another 8 years of this, Buckeye fans.
Rick Barnes doing surprisingly decent at Tennessee.
Shockingly so.
By the way, there's like 16 and 15. So.
No, but they were gutted by Pearl leaving. And they haven't really... And then it was just straight roiling chaos for, what, 4 years?
Yeah, there was that year they made the tournament. And then, like, they went to, like, the Sweet 16, and then, oh, yeah, they hired Donnie Tindall. And that, like, ruined their program.
Yeah, but even when they had the great year, it was still... Yeah, didn't
24-13.
Yeah, didn't Martin leave after that year? In, like, May?
He did. To take the cow job.
Yeah. That says something.
They went all the way to the... Wow. No, I guess they played a Dayton game. That's why. It's like, how did they win 3 games and not make it to the second weekend?
Because they barely got there. They got relegated to play-in status.
They got a gift with the Mercer team that, what, beat Duke?
Yeah. I'd like to think of them as the Mercer team that beat Dunk City as Dunk City was defending whatever fucking conference they were in champions.
Dunk City, that's just never going to die, is it?
It's phenomenal branding. And they have steered so completely into it that I love it.
I watched at least their final. They don't do anything crazy. They're just a solid team. Dunk City at it again. Back to the tournament.
Yeah, because it's Dunk City. I still will find the Deadspin page with the video from that run. I'll just Google that once a month. No lie. It's just joy. It's just joyful.
Currently, look, they have them locked in as a 14 seed. I think if there's any way that they UCLA doesn't move up a lot, if they ended up playing UCLA, I think they could beat them. As crazy as that sounds, which I know it sounds very crazy.
UCLA is the most high variance team in college basketball. If they hit their averages, they are very, very good. If they hit above average, you're just not going to win. But if they have a bad shooting night, they could lose to anybody.
So they just don't really care about defending very much.
Which, this is a shock, is a problem in tournament basketball when you can lose one game and stop playing. Not to be super literal about shit, but if you can't defend a little bit. It's kind of a problem.
A very, very fair point. So, before we wrap this up, who's your prediction to win the AAC tournament?
I think UC is going to do it, and I think I'm so encouraged by how they responded to laying a complete fucking egg for no damn good reason against UCF. Now, it has to be said, those two wins, while massive, don't really account for much, because Connecticut's in turmoil. That's delicate. And Houston's not very good. Period. Oh, and it was the last game in Fifth Third Arena. They could have played the Monstars. They were not losing that game.
And definitely not.
That crowd was about as good as it gets for old Fifth Third Arena. They hit that level that they can, but don't often do lately. But yeah, when they bring it, they bring it like nobody else, and it becomes one of the toughest places to play in the country, if not the conference.
Yeah, definitely. That point in the Houston game where they just made that run in the first half. That's just incredible. Houston didn't have a chance.
No, they just they got avalanched. it was just that's a little bit of snow. This shouldn't hurt this much. Oh, shit. I can't ski fast enough. That was me narrating Houston's experience in the last 5 minutes of the first half of that game. Because that's really where it ended.
Yeah. And then, UC just opened up the second half, put almost the same exact way, and it was over. And, UConn is... Yeah, I don't even know what that was. That was one of the worst shooting performances I think I've ever seen.
That is quite a statement.
That was probably way over dramatic. But they were 15 of 48. That's pretty awful.
Yeah, they weren't good. But it's not because UConn players can't shoot. It's because every shot was contested. That's how I judge my bad shooting performances. It's not whether or not the shot goes in. It's, is it even guarded? Like, if you're guarded and you just can't make a shot, that's fine. It happens. Occasionally you get guarded. It's basketball. If you're wide open and you can't hit the backside of the barn, that's a different issue. Ask USF. Or half the teams at the bottom half of this conference, really. Where did the conference end up in effective field goal percentage? I'm guessing dead last, right?
Yes. Yes, dead last.
Yeah, they took that wire to wire.
Like, oh, we're not only the slowest league, but we also can't shoot very well.
Yeah, we're not only the slowest league, we're going to compound that problem by not being able to shoot. At all. Not even a little bit.
Also the worst two-point shooting league in the nation.
I call that, it's not entirely the Taco Fall effect, but it's kind of the Taco Fall effect.
Definitely. And when you can't actually score on, like, the top. But we'll throw in Houston. Like, the top four defenses are all the elite to, like, above average. Even, like, going to Memphis is, like, a little above average. And, like, yeah, that's the, like, top five teams. And, like, these offenses are, like, historically garbage, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I mean, really, there's just no good offense. Well, there's a couple good offenses, and yeah, some of the worst offenses in the country. And it's like not even just this year, but for like recent history.
Yeah, South Florida didn't even end up with the worst offense, which is like
is all you need to know. If South Florida, a team that fired their coach midway through the season, had, I don't know, like has like four high major level players, maybe, because everybody transferred.
What?
And not like four that play, like four on the roster. And I think one of them's injured. Yeah, it's just the depths of futility when it comes to offense in this league. I mean, you could write a book about it. It's going to be like a really depressing, it's going to be like a Russian novel.
Yeah. Like
just Kukowski long, voluminous, like, yeah. Not happy at all. It's aspirational. Sure. But in the end, the sinking realization that, it's just kind of who we are. And there was a point, like, midway through conference season where everybody was just like, yeah, this is all we are. No more trying. We'll see you next year.
AAC, third in blowout percentage, where 21 of the 99 games were blowouts, which is greater than 19 points. And 26th in close game percentage. We're only 17 games were within 4 points or went to overtime. So, yeah.
What were you saying about no middle class?
Yeah. Like even the even your Temples are like blowing out the teams in the bottom half of the league. When then Temple turns around and gets like blown out. Pick a dark horse. Which it would be anybody besides UC and SMU. If a dark horse was going to steal the bid, who would it be?
UConn. They're not good, but they are talented. And if, for whatever reason, Jalen Adams and Purvis and all these dudes just suddenly get hot, they can do it. And it's home. I just don't see it for anybody else. Like, even if Rob Gray and Damian Dotson go out of their fucking skulls, shooting wise. Houston's just not good enough defensively.
Mine would be UCF, just because of the taco effect, which means
just
UCF
because of the abnormality involved in playing taco fall.
And they have one guy who can score.
One guy is more than enough in this league. I mean, if anything, SMU and Cincinnati should be punished for hoarding all the scorers.
They really should. There's going to be like a class action lawsuit after the season ends.
It's like, hey, you got too many guys who are good on offense. You can recruit better. No, we want one of yours.
Yeah. Even then, like, if UCF like makes a miracle run to the final, they'd have to hope UC lost. So I don't think that they could beat Cincinnati twice. But maybe they could. Both of those games were pretty close.
Well, they were pretty close, but it's like they were pretty close because UC played into the hands of a UCF. Like, the greatest asset UCF has on either end is Taco Fall. So what's the solution to that? You run him off the floor. You play at a pace that he cannot sustain. You play at a pace where he can't last longer than 6 minutes without needing a break. If you walk the ball up the floor every single time, you're really giving... You're not making them pay the cost of playing tackle fall. Right? Because he's really good at what he does. He's a phenomenal defensive player. He alters shots 10 feet from the rim. Historically, there's not many guys who alter shots from that range.
Yeah, definitely not.
I mean, Gary Clark had a 12-foot jumper swatted back into his face. I don't think Gary Clark has had a jumper blocked.
Yeah, period.
In his entire life. So, like, that's just what you're dealing with in terms of the strangeness of playing it. So you have to punish UCF for playing him. You can't do that walking the ball up the court. You just can't.
And like even on the other end, like so much of their offense is spurned on by him. Like not really because of his scoring. Like, although if you give him a chance to like put up like I don't know, like 15 or 20, he's definitely capable. Because he can dunk and make easy shots. But, like, just because of how he rebounds. Like, being taller than everybody is a gigantic advantage.
Well, yeah, especially when their entire offense seems to revolve around B.J. Taylor driving to the hole. And you know it's an easier offensive rebound for a guy Taco Fall size? A shot right off the rim. You know it's very hard for him to rebound? A three. Unless it goes right to his face.
You just probably just put his arm up, and if it was on his side before, he would catch it.
Yeah, I mean, like, they did such, like, he is the most impactful limited player in the last 10 years. Like, everybody compared him to Mamadou Njai at UC Irvine, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
But Njai moved. He was a very effective offensive player. Like, they ran their offense through him. And it's not because he's just a 7'6" dude who can stand under the hoop and get buckets, you know? Like, he is a legitimately skilled player. And not just, like, for his size. Like, he's skilled for college basketball players. Like, his skill level is in the upper echelon of Division I players. Not 7'6" Division I players, like Division I players, period. That's... Taco Fall is not that. But he demands so much attention. Like, they run pick and rolls, and in his role from the 3-point line to the hoop, he'll get like four forearm shivers to the rib. Like, you just have to bump him.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, that opens other shit up. It would be more effective if UCF had, I don't know, shooters. A couple? Maybe one? One would help.
Yeah, interesting. UCF's, like, 3-point like attempts per game skyrocketed in league play. I'm not sure how much of that was actually because, like, they got forced into those positions. But they ended up shooting it better than league play, which is kind of a surprise. They have like, Matt Williams. That guy only shot threes. Taco Fall, on the year, only attempted 109 free throws. Kind of really low for somebody, like, that big. So you think, like, he would end up in positions where he'd just get, like, hacked to hell. But no.
And he did.
He did, but, like, he does not get calls.
Look, I mean, like, let's call it what it is. Officiating in college basketball is fucking atrocious. It is the biggest problem why quality of play is so low. It's because the officials are all independent contractors.
And
which means they have no union. There's no bargaining rights. The training sucks. And because of that, like, games are called wildly different from league to league, from ref to ref, from night to night. The same ref will do different shit.
Yeah, definitely, just because, and, like, they travel all around the country. It's really no yeah. way to, like, even it out.
Yeah, but generally, I think, and maybe this is just my opinion, but flying forearm shivers to the 7'6", 290-pound dude, I don't care if they don't knock him off course. It's still a foul.
Mick Cronin, like, just complained about this earlier today, or whenever it was reported.
Oh, we're getting targeted for hard fouls bit?
Yeah, yes. Like, Gary Clark got, like, smacked in the face and they didn't call anything, I guess.
Yeah, that was an egregious non-call.
Like, anytime somebody ends up bleeding. Like, that's really the only time you're supposed to call fouls when somebody bleeds.
Yeah, even if it's a retroactive foul on the person who made him bleed 3 minutes later, that should still, like, that should be accounted for later. It's like, foul on Amita Brahma. For what? He's on the bench. He did make him bleed 3 minutes ago. Good point.
Do you think there's anything to Cronin's, at least, like, nationally picked up comments lately? We'll talk about this real quick before we close. How he was pretty public about ranting about the selection committee. And saying, like, oh, you only get seated where you do because so they can sell tickets. And now, like, he's publicly complaining about officiating. Do you think this is going to, like, come back negatively against UC? Or is there really just nothing else to talk about regarding UC besides what Mick Cronin's saying?
How could it possibly have any more, like, just on an outcome basis, the way that UC has been treated by the AAC office, like, really, how much worse could it get? They do the no favors in scheduling football or basketball. They don't, you know, have any, like, UC is one of the flagship programs in this school, and that's in this conference, and that's all sports. But it seems like their input is not hardly sought on anything. They seem to go out of their way to see, you know, what's going to work for Memphis or, you know, East Carolina. What do you guys need? It's like, that's not how most of these leagues are run. And you can say that it's a bad thing that the, you know, the SEC office might as well be based in Tuscaloosa and that the Big 12 has really run out of Austin and Norman. But, like, has that had a negative effect on the other schools in terms of how they are perceived? I'd argue no. Like, you gotta protect your assets. And the AAC, let's be frank, doesn't have a tremendous amount of assets. I mean, they got UConn basketball, men's and women's, UC, Memphis basketball, Houston football. And that's the list.
Yeah, that's a pretty short list. I guess you could add UCF football, maybe.
If they get back. Historically, they've been kind of mediocre.
True. But the league does prop them up every time they're good.
True. But, like, it's just... Like, Mick is officially in a, well, fuck it. How much worse can this get phase of his career? And I enjoy it because it's more interesting. Like, he's just, like, you know, he might not go on long dissertations about, you know, pirates and the Caribbean circa 1780, like Mike Leach. But his level of fucks given is very Mike Leach.
It seems like it's only dropped lately.
So, yeah, he gave out all his fucks this year. He is fresh out. He might have new fucks to give next year, but he's out for now.
It's not like they don't, like the coaches, like they don't talk about the seeds. Of course they do. Like, I don't know, like if it's, like, purely about selling tickets, you would think that Cincinnati and St. Joseph's wouldn't be playing in Spokane, Washington in front of, like, a 30% filled arena.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, but that's the thing. The NCAA cares about tickets sold. They don't care about actual attendance. And all of those tickets are sold. And they're dumped back onto the resale market as soon as their team, you know, whoever bought the tickets, as soon as their team is not in there, in that market, they dump them on the secondary market and you can get them for pennies on the dollar. So they're trying to sell tickets, true, but this is arguably the most popular sporting event in America every single year. It really doesn't matter where you send teams. It really doesn't matter what you seed them at. You're going to sell the tickets.
That's not always true, because, like, some of these you have to, like, just eat your allotment if you don't send enough people.
True, but that's for the first round games. And honestly, the first round games are the loss leader of this equation. Like, you have to take that loss to get to the Sweet 16 Elite Eight round, where now that they're all played in NBA venues almost every single year, they're sold out year after year, all the time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, once you get to the second round where you're sending teams to
the Sweet 16. And the tickets are like three times more expensive for that second weekend. Rightfully so. Market, you know, the market is the market. But you can afford to take a loss on all these games, you know, at far-flung sites like Boise.
Comes a point where there's like a definite advantage to have like a UCLA playing out west and like Duke playing out like in Atlanta or something like that. Where like their fans will travel and they'll make a ton of money.
Well, yeah, and for the teams, it's really interesting that the NCAA tournament hasn't gotten to this point, but I'm a huge soccer fan. One of my favorite events is the World Cup. I love it. I don't care. Like, I really do care what kind of despotic regime with massive human rights violations they give it to. But I really don't. I'm going to watch anyways. I'm going to feel bad about it because I'm Catholic. Well, I'm not actually Catholic, but I was raised Catholic. So that guilt just kind of gets deep in your soul. But the first thing that happens when they announce the draw is everybody goes on Google and they start measuring distances to see who has to travel the farthest, because the travel has a huge effect, especially on college kids who aren't used to traveling these huge distances. You know, I don't know if anybody has noticed, but America is a fucking massive country. Like, you can go a long way without leaving the country. Miami to Seattle is like that's almost 4,000 miles, right? It's a long trip. So, like, you can have a really, really long travel schedule where the other team doesn't, and that presents an advantage for the team that, you know, if UC has to go out to play USC in Phoenix, I don't even know if that's the site, whatever, hypothetical, who has the advantage there? USC. It's not just because they have fans there, it's because they can take a bus to Phoenix. Yeah, and bus travel is easier on athletes.
Definitely, that's even one of the other things that Cronin was talking about recently. So there aren't any bus trips in this league. It's just, like, mentioned, every other league you pretty much get those. Like, Tobacco Road, obviously. The way the Pac-12 schedules, like, you at least get your one local rival and a whole week off. Even in the Big 12, they're still a lot closer than besides West Virginia. Like, in this league, it's just so, like, scattered across the entire country. It's like a lot of traveling. I wonder how big an impact this has as teams get further and further into the season. It'd be something interesting to study. But we really couldn't study it without the proper information.
We could speculate wildly. I'm just saying it's an option. I'm not saying we should do it. I'm just saying we could.
Then the team out of this league did win the national title, so I guess that would just, like, skew everything terribly and ruin it.
True, but they won that national title in a conference town. Yeah, they did. So they were used to being in Houston.
Well, the solution the whole time.
Yeah, just make sure that you have a probable Final Four destination in your conference. That way, you're familiar with the area.
I'm pretty sure didn't that UConn team play Villanova in, like, New York City?
Yep, they played in New York City.
Even then, that would get pretty helpful early trip. So I do remember they had a gigantic crowd advantage in that game.
Yeah, because they had Nova and Michigan State. And it was basically Gamble.
Yeah. Before we leave, the real last topic, like, how terrible is the conference tournament in Hartford? Like, it really should be. Like, if they're going to put it anywhere, they should just put it at the Pyramid. It's a nice place. It looks better on TV. And it's, like, at least it's, like, a real arena. Like, it's like watching all these other tournaments at the big fancy arena. So it, like, feels, if yours isn't there, it feels second rate. Like, that's a terrible stereotyping, but it's true.
You do know that the Pyramid is currently a Bass Pro Shop, right?
Not the Pyramid, the whatever they play at. No, I'm old. I don't know Memphis's arena.
FedEx Forum.
The new
Come on, Pyramid. It's Memphis. Of course FedEx sponsors it.
The new pier, whatever it's called. It's a pier.
They are probably the entirety of that town. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it even says on the keys to City Hall, property of Fred Smith. Pretty sure.
Could have been. It's like they tried to, like, spend all their money to get Memphis in the Big 12. Back when,
The funniest part about that is they didn't actually spend any money. They said, oh, if this happens, we commit to do this, 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 and this. That's the best kind of money to spend, is hypothetical money.
I think if they did put the conference tournament in Memphis again, FedEx I think they would try to get them to sponsor it.
Yeah, honestly, Memphis is the best option.
They'd have to get good again for that to happen, though.
It's either that or you go to home arenas. So, have played at Gamble one year. Honestly, why not? What difference does it make? This is about TV, not about attendance. When you see gets Fifth Third Arena renovated, play it there.
The only problem with that is, I guess really, would be nobody would care about the other games. But that's already a problem.
How is that any different than what we have? It's the same downside with none of the upside. What they're doing now is, by playing it in noted basketball hotbeds like Orlando. And, didn't they just sign up Temple?
I'm not sure. Probably.
Honestly, it should be a 4-city rotation. Should be Memphis. Should be Philadelphia. Cincinnati and stores. And if you don't like it, get better at basketball.
I think that's a pretty solid way to end the podcast. We'll try to come back early next week to talk about everything brackets. And hopefully the next time we do the podcast, we'll be celebrating an AAC title and like a number one seed somehow.
Did everybody die? Did the rapture happen?
That was... I was just trying to be... I'm really optimistic I went overboard. But yes. The ACC again, the AAC combined to Super League, where UC has the best profile now.
Fantastic.